Thanks, Rick. And now, would you please join me in welcoming our speaker from Santa Monica, Wayne Bee.
Wayne Butler, alcoholic.
Wayne.
I want to thank Chris for inviting me to come back here again. It's really interesting to get invited back. The first time doesn't surprise me. The second time is very interesting. I want to thank Dave for picking me up at the airport and hauling me around and giving me a good lunch. And we had a great conversation. We sat and gossiped and judged for all over 2 hours. Then when he stopped talking, I started. I love AA. It's not a chore for me to come and do this. I don't necessarily like to talk, but I make the best of it that I can. My sponsor told me years ago that God picks the AA participants. He said, when your phone rings and you're asked to do something in AA that's legitimate, he said that's God calling in disguise. He said, so feel free to say no anytime you like. I haven't said no yet. My sobriety date is November 8th, 1977. I haven't had any pills, powders, potions, or lotions. I've been told by some people I need it. One person told me once, you know, it wouldn't hurt for you to have a drink. I said, I know. Last week was tough. I want to welcome all you newcomers. I'm going to help you with a favor. Don't judge AA by my presentation. If you don't identify with me, that'd be an easy way to leave AA. So if you don't identify with me, perhaps you can find something similar. Even if it's my bald head, we don't care what it takes to fit you here. If you identify, you identify. If you laugh, you're in, so hold your breath tonight. And if you make yourself not laugh, that's a qualifier, too. If you judge me, that's a qualifier. So most of you are qualified already. Those of you that are new, I want to share with you the good news and the bad news. We'll just get it out of the way right now. The good news is you have found your way into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The bad news is you have found yourself in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you can stay sober in AA, you can stay sober anywhere. I don't mean no disrespect. I remember I was 5 years sober, and I was happy. Happy. I got sober November 8th, and for no good reason, I was happy. I was in debt up to my ears and didn't own nothing. I was in trouble with the law. I was in the middle of a divorce. My kids wouldn't talk to me, and I was happy. My sponsor calls that a delusion. He said, that's what we call the pink cloud. You're happy for no good reason. Now, that lasted for 5 years, one day at a time. And I came home from an AA dance when I was 5 years sober and found my wife in bed with my sponsee. Apparently, he wanted what I had. It looked like he was willing to go to any lengths to get it. That was 23 years ago. I miss my sponsee. So if you're new and you're on a pink cloud, hang in there. I'm only going to make one small suggestion. Pack your pink parachute. It is what it is. I love AIDS. Did I mention that? If you're new, that's about the most profound thing I've got to share with you, is that I can, of my own free will, say I love AA and know what it means. It means that I'm willing to give myself to AA. That's what that means. I thought love meant you do for me when I got here. Matter of fact, I didn't even have the capacity. If I said I love you, it's because I wanted something. Period. See, I was committed to something when I got here, and I didn't know I was. I was committed to feeling better. I was not committed to getting better. And there's a strong difference between the two. Because I found out getting better means painstaking effort. And when you're committed to feeling better like I was, when it stopped feeling better, I stopped doing it. And found something else to make me feel better. First time my sponsor growled at me, I did not feel better. He hurt my feeling. And I left. Every time something made me feel bad in AA, I blamed AA and left. I had no idea that I was under the influence of a commitment to feeling better. I drank to feel better. I had sex to feel better. By the way, my sponsor told me when I did my sex inventory that I was committed to feeling better, and that's why I had sex. And he said that that might be out the realm of what God intended. He said, if you're doing it to feel better, he said, that's not natural. And that baffled me for a long time. Money made me feel better. Power. Violence made me feel better. Even when I got my butt whooped, it was worth it. Because for just a little while, I felt better. And I came into AA that way. When you got me, I got to tell you something. When I came to AA 33 years ago, I was committed to feeling better at all costs. I was a racist. I was a bigot. Somewhat prejudiced. Didn't like women, didn't trust men, and my psych report read, Wayne does not play well with pets. So I was a bit of a loner. And I remember when I admitted to my sponsor, I'm a racist. Now, that's not something you go around admitting, is it? That was a tough one, but I knew I had to because I wasn't going to get better. I might feel better, but I'm not going to get better. My sponsor said, I'll tell you what you do. Ask God for help with that, and you'll get it. Now, what I ask for and what I get don't come in the same package. I was also homophobic. My first sponsee was gay. My second sponsee was of color. My third sponsee was a woman. I didn't know that. You know what I mean? And that is really my experience in a nutshell. Every turn where I've suffered a difficulty in my life, when I've asked for help, it's like, if you want patience, don't pray for that. Because that ain't what you're going to get. You're going to get a car wreck. You're going to get stalled traffic. You're going to get something that, you know what I mean? So I pray for other people's patience. I'm a giver. I suppose I should talk about drinking, huh? Since this is AA. I drank beer. I'm a beer-drinking-only alcoholic. 33 years ago, it was rare. Most people where I come from in Illinois were blue-collar, whiskey-drinking, barroom brawlers. That's what they were. That describes my dad. And I'm not going to tell you too much about my family because they can't defend themselves here. And I'm not here to talk about them. I'm just going to briefly mention them to qualify how I reacted to it. My dad was a truck driver, drove truck for 32 years, and he was a bare-knuckle fighting maniac, loved to fight. My mom was about 5 foot nothing. I used to say 200 pounds, but I'm afraid she's going to come out of the grave and get me, probably 160. No fat. My mother was a bodybuilder, and she worked in the carnival, the Royal American Shows. She was a wrestler. She had tattoos over two-thirds of her body. She had a flying eagle. Now, this was when it wasn't cool, girls. This was back when they judged you. They didn't find it sexy. She had a flying eagle tattooed on each forearm, and my mom had a full double-breasted eagle across her back. She had other tattoos, but that's, quite frankly, none of your business. And they used to call my mom a painted lady once. And I would watch my mom and dad fight. I'd watch all the carrying on, and it was fun. It was a party. It's like, I didn't know I was in a bad home until I went to therapy. And when they pointed all that out to me, I had a grievous childhood. And I did. Not here to talk about that either. That's a different program. My book tells me that AA can solve all my problems if I'm willing to allow AA to solve all my problems. I didn't believe that. I've got to tell you. I've been psychiatrically institutionalized 17 times, and I have to tell you that I liked it there. I was a self-sign-in 15 times. And I'm going to tell you why, in case you have a little slippy poo. Given the way I drank out there and the way I acted, I couldn't get a date on the street to save my life. But you put me in a co-ed psych ward. And I'm a pretty charming fella. I could strike up conversation with any of them. And if they were on Thorazine, ladies, I got to warn you, AA can be like that a lot. I saw some of you stand up for your first year. I watched every one of you. Now, if I come up to you after this meeting, those of you ladies in your first year, and if I say something to you like this, and I might even posture a little bit, I might say something like this. I might say, hey, would you like to go have coffee? And talk about God? If I do that, run! Oh, quit judging me right now. I love Budweiser. I love it to this day. If I could drink it, according to what Silkworth says in our book, I would. I don't have resentment against Budweiser, Anheuser-Busch, the Clydesdales, any of them. As a matter of fact, when I see the Clydesdales in a parade, I weep. When I pass by a Budweiser billboard, I got to slow down and have a moment of silence. That's not natural. Do you know them earth people hardly even notice those billboards? You know that, don't you? They sure don't worship them. They don't salute the wagon. There's something strange about me, and Silkworth alludes to that in my book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got a lot of interesting things going on inside me. I have a predisposition that I didn't know about till I found you. And when I say I've been through all kinds of therapy, I'm not putting it down. I'm just reporting. I've been diagnosed almost everything but schizophrenic in the DSM-3. Thank God they came out with the DSM-4 after I got sober. I've been diagnosed borderline personality, personality disorder, character disorder, bipolar, bipolar manic depressive, bipolar manic with a chemical imbalance. I've been diagnosed sober, go figure. And I was misdiagnosed every single time. Innocently. My symptoms would appear strange at the time. But it's funny how my symptoms straighten out when I'm around you. That's not natural either. The book says we are people who normally would not mix. Really? Boy, that's an under... Is that an overstatement? I look around this room and I got it right away. We're people who normally would not mix. I'm a kid. I don't fit in nowhere. I'm plagued with feelings I don't belong, I'm not a part of. My constant thought is, what's wrong with me? I look at you and I feel less than. For no reason, I just do. No one did that to me. I just picked that up on the natch. I feel like a human turd in the punch bowl of life. And as I float around, you're out there saying, ah, how'd that get in here? Get it out of here. That's how I felt. I remember looking in the mirror somewhere between the age of 8 and 9, and I said to myself, Butler, it's too bad, pal. It's going to be a long life. And it's going to be lonely because you are butt ugly. I said that to me. I don't know where that came from. Mama Butler never sat me down and said, oh, you poor little son of a... Oh. You know, just out of mercy alone, I'd put you back if I could. That's not what she said, but that's what I heard. When she said, Wayne, I love you. Isn't that interesting? People say nice things to me. That's not what I hear. There's something broken inside of me, and I can't figure it out. And all I can tell you is when I drink, it seems to fix it, alleviate it. And if alcohol does that for me, why in God's name would I just quit? Only I don't know that because this is the illness that happens beneath the level of radar. You see, Silkworth talks to me in my book. He said, abnormal drinkers like me drink essentially because I like the effect produced by alcohol. What a powerful statement. What a powerful statement. Because that abnormal, unusual, and he goes on to say, unconscious, illusionary effect. In other words, it's happening, but I'm not consciously aware of it, and I am condemned and committed to pursue that illusionary effect until it either kills me, institutionalizes me, or I get help. And that's why alcohol for me is so cunning, baffling, and powerful, as the book says, because it does something inside me, beneath my consciousness, that I don't know is happening, and yet I will defend it with every ounce left in me. That is a baffling condition. And the only people it doesn't baffle is guess who? Those of us that you don't want to identify with. Nobody wants to identify with a crazy person. And yet you laugh. So I know something's terribly wrong with me. Thank God we have this book. I don't worship this book, but I sure do love it. I'm going to tell you why. I'm terribly judgmental. I am. I'm not going to stand up here tonight and lie to you one bit. I'm going to tell you the way it is. I'm judgmental. I'm better today, though. I don't mean better at judging. I mean I'm better at... You know what I mean. Tell you why I like this book, because it doesn't judge me. I've tried to find it so I can dismiss it. And so I read this book, and you know what I found out? It's open-ended. It's a living, breathing instrument. Because no matter where I get into it, wherever my mind is, I'm there. And it doesn't judge me if I make a mistake. It doesn't admonish me if I don't live perfectly. As a matter of fact, it says, we know you're not going to. So we have steps to take care of my human failure. God, how can you not love something like that? How can you not honor something like that? And that's why I honor this thing, by trying to conform to the best of my ability to what the elders have asked me to do in AA. They've asked me to conform to certain principles, like tonight I've been asked to wear a coat and tie. It's no big deal to me. That's a small price to pay for what I have, isn't it? When I'm asked to sit still and be quiet, that's a small price for me to pay. I don't impose that on nobody else. It's for me. Because I love this thing. I want to honor this thing. Why? Because I haven't been in a psych ward for 28 years and a couple of weeks as a patient. I haven't seen that look in my mother's eye prior to her death that I saw so often. I got a phone call last week. My daughter called me. And she was informing me that I'm not welcome for Thanksgiving dinner again. Now, some people might take that the wrong way. I'm glad my daughter called me and told me that. Her mother wanted to make sure I wasn't coming to town. Now, there's two ways to handle that. One, I can just hang up and pout. Or I can thank my daughter for the phone call, because it took a lot of courage for her to call her dad and tell her that, to tell me that, didn't it? And you know what? It didn't bother me at all. I said, I love you. Now, the first time I got that phone call after our divorce, I wasn't quite as happy, joyous, and free. How did I get from 8 or 9, when I was so butt ugly I couldn't stand it, to where Budweiser became a solution for me, to where I can take a phone call like that and not hold a grudge against anybody? How does that happen? If you're new, it happens very slowly. That is the good and the bad news. But it happens. And we're usually the last ones to know that the transition has taken place. And the only way to know it is to work with other alcoholics, because I see in their change my own growth. If I don't work with others, I don't see my own growth. And then one day I'm going to have to rely upon Budweiser again, because Budweiser done something for me once that I still remember today. And it's been a long time. And the best way to describe it for you newcomers is to explain to you what I understand about my illness. The book Alcoholics Anonymous suggests to me that I have an illness of the mind and the emotions, that I have a soul sickness. And my soul sickness is the reason why I hear funny and I see funny. I even talk funny. What I say may not make no sense to nobody else but me. But I'm distorted. I don't see things the way they really are. And I can't explain that to you. When I tell that to a doctor, they gave me a pill. And they had no other choice. I'm high maintenance for them, because I never found one single doctor I found it necessary to tell them the truth, ever. But I know at the age of 17, when I took my first drink, something happened to me inside that I will never forget. It's on the hard drive. And if you got a hard drive like mine, it's there. Can't erase it. It's a hard drive that can't be erased unless I, myself, decide to erase it. And here's what it is. This illness of my mind and my emotions that is coupled with a soul sickness, here's how it comes out in me. But the best metaphor I can give you to explain my mindset that really does need a drink is, mentally, I'm a thinker. I'm analytical. I like to figure stuff out. I especially like to figure it out when they say, don't think. Why not? I got to think about that. Isn't that interesting? I've always felt like a square peg trying to fit in a round hole. So this is what I think I was born like. Not you, but me. I believe mentally I was born like a Rubik's Cube. Square head, 27 little cubes, all doing their own thing. Did you know that there's 6 sides to each cube? There's 27 cubes in a Rubik's Cube. That's 162 sides. Bet you never figured that out, have you? If you peel the tape off when you get frustrated, that's 162 sides. Now, doing a mathematical factoring process, that equals out to 34 quintillion possible combinations. That's a lot like my old ideas. And my head works a lot like that. Clickety, 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 clickety. They call that ADD. ADHD. And I'll describe it for you. Rhea, Chris, and I could be having a perfectly legitimate, reasonable conversation, right? And I'm looking right at Chris while he's talking to me. Then all of a sudden he notices my eyes is glazed over. I'm still looking right at him, but I've gone somewhere. You see, I clicked. I had another thought, and I'm not really interested in his, I'm interested in mine. But I want him to think I'm still interested, so I focus towards him, but I'm over here. And then somebody walks by, and then I go over there. And then the priest says, hey, what? Are you listening to me? Yeah, what'd I say? Shut up. I need some help. Emotionally, I'm a lot like a broken Maytag washing machine. I seem to have been born without a normal cycle. And I've been stuck on agitate and spin. Interestingly enough, if you open the lid up, pour a couple Budweisers in the tub, it balances the load. You hear me? It ain't supposed to do that. See, alcohol is not supposed to have any kind of effect except one. I didn't know this, newcomer. Alcohol is a depressant. But that's how they lost me. They told me alcohol was a depressant. I said, no. Never depressed me. Made me so good looking, I couldn't stand it. When I drink, I can talk to girls. When I drink, I'm not afraid of men. When I drink, I can dance. When I drink, I can talk. When I'm not drinking, I can't. I'm off to myself. And I'm in bad company. When I drink, I like everybody. I give myself a group hug. What can be bad about that? You see, alcohol doesn't do that to the average drinker, says Silkworth. 9 out of 10 people, they say, can drink what they call normally. You see, when they drink, it is a depressant. And you can tell by the way they talk. They say things like, I'm starting to feel it. The hell does that mean? Explain that. I better slow down. I've never heard that at my bar. I better slow down. I'm driving home tonight. Do you know what we call this? Probable cause. Is there something wrong with me? I don't know what. All I drink is beer. I can't be alcoholic. And why am I? I'm attached to Budweiser. I'm attached to the bottle. How many of you have been on agitate and spin, needing that drink? It's all I can think about because I've had to stay sober all day. And she wants me home for din-din. I know if I call her, the war's going to begin. So I'm going to sneak and stop without her permission. Now I'm concerned about that. I'm out of my minds. I get within 50 feet of Larry's Oasis, and I see the front door knob, and my shoulders start to go like this. And then I get my hand on the door. I open the door. Have you noticed I haven't drank yet? That's an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I'm already relaxing. I see Rusty and Rocky shooting pool. Rusty sees me. I see him put a quarter up on the table for me. I notice out of my peripheral vision, Larry putting up 2 bottles of Budweiser on the bar. I haven't even drank yet, and I'm better already. I walk over and I grab one of the Budweisers, and you'd think I don't drink it right away. I grab it like this, and I look at the bottle. Haven't you ever done that? Read the label. Wonder what's in there. I grab it, and I go just like this. Didn't you ever do that? Walk around the bar like... That's not normal drinking. I'm getting relief and it's not even in me yet. When I drink it, I have a spiritual experience. When I drink alcohol, I experience a psychic change in my perception of reality. I go from being butt ugly and retarded... Goofy. Let me give you that example. I was 17 years old. Now, in eighth grade, back in the day, they didn't understand alcoholism much better than they understand it today. I got diagnosed mentally retarded. Go figure. Now, if you have a child that's special because of organicity, I mean no disrespect by what I'm about to say. I was diagnosed retarded. I got put in a retarded class. I got put in a retarded group home. They said I was the brightest of the bunch. Do you know I stayed there and graduated high school in a retarded class? Rode the short bus everywhere I went. I majored in putt-putt golf. That's what we did. We went to the Moline Miniature Putt-Putt Golf Course on 23rd Avenue every afternoon, Monday through Friday, and that was our class schedule. I won 2 gold putters. Ladies and gentlemen, that's absolutely the truth. I was convinced I was retarded. That felt better than not knowing what's wrong with me. It's interesting, isn't it? And we had a guy named Tom who was our chaperone who looked over us because there's some bullies in school. You know who you are. You're here. I saw you already. Now, I'm not playing the victim because victims don't stay sober. I'm just reporting. You know, the wrestlers and the basketball players and the football players, they like to have fun with us kids in the special class. They would get us after school and they would do things like wrap athletic tape around our ankles. Was you ever in Illinois? They'd run a rope through it and they'd rung us up the rings upside down and leave us hanging there. And then one weekend, our school got those 5-foot tall lockers. This was back in 63. And on a Friday night, the wrestlers took 3 of us and locked each one of us in a locker. And they didn't find us till Monday. That did not make me alcoholic, but it put a definite spin on my personalities. I didn't know about resentment, but I came out of there with resentment. And I'll tell you how long that resentment festered. In 1968, there was a little conflict going on full force. They were taking people no matter what their handicap was, unless they were just stone cold crazy. And you know what? I got enlisted in the Navy and I found myself in Vietnam by Thanksgiving, 1968. When I came back from Vietnam the second time, I remembered those guys, and I went and found all 4 of them, got even with all 4 of them. Let me tell you something. If I'd have known about steps 8 and 9, I would have forgave them. The effect produced by alcohol was so powerful in me. I was a senior in the special class, and Tom took me to the senior dance. Never been to a dance. I lived in a group home. There wasn't no dancing going on over there. But there was also not the madness of the alcoholic home going on there either. So I didn't mind it. Tom took me to the senior dance. I'm standing up against a wall watching people do things I didn't understand, afraid someone might talk to me. Tom walks over to me, standing against the wall. Tom was my hero. I would have drank battery acid because, remember those guys that I got even with? Tom beat the hell out of them for me. He stood up for me. He was my hero. So when Tom said, here, drink this, it'll make you feel better, it was a bottle of Budweiser. Drank it right down. And I said, Tom, that tastes terrible. I want a Pepsi Cola. I'll never forget his words. He said, that's okay, kid. You'll get used to it. Now, Tom's one of them earth drinkers to this very day. By the way, I've known Tom my whole life. Tom and I are still friends today. Tom does not know what you've done to me. He thinks you're an unretarding program. He does. Because he doesn't understand, nor does he have to. Tom got drunk the first time, and here's what happened to Tom. He got disorientated, peed in his dresser, almost went crazy trying to flush it, and said, I'm not doing that again. And he hasn't done that again, so he says to me. That's what he meant would happen to me, but you see, I'm an abnormal drinker. What he meant is not what happened to me. I experienced an absolute psychic change in my mind. I was at that dance, and I swear, I went to that dance, the biggest thing in my body was an infected pimple. I just felt bad about myself. I don't have to explain to you, do I? Somewhere between four and five Budweisers, I got so good looking I couldn't stand it. I looked out on that dance floor and eyeballed a blue-eyed blonde dancing with some loser. I went from retarded to gifted. Didn't know I was going to need freedom from blondage. I went out on a dance floor and asked her if I could cut in. She said yes. Found out later that night sex meant two people. I didn't know that. They didn't give us sex ed in the special class. I don't think they wanted us reproducing. She ruined my sex life. I've been having sex since I was 13, in my opinion. I thought I was pretty good at it. And she complicated the entire process. I swore I was never doing that again. And I didn't until I drank. And that was how I drank. Because something happened inside my mind that is unconscious and inaccessible to my awareness. I experienced a psychic change because of alcohol. And I'm going to suggest to you, ladies and gentlemen, that that's exactly why I drank every time. Even when the pain became almost insurmountable, I would still drink, unbeknownst to me, because I'm chasing that elusive effect produced. And I didn't even find out about that till I met you and sat with you for a number of years, all the way up to my last drink. I had no idea it was going to be my last drink. I've been going to meetings for 5 years drinking. I'm what they called a slipper. Thank God no one judged me. No one says, you know, you got to try working a program. No, that's judgment cloaked behind a well-meaning phrase. They said to me, keep coming back. They would say things like, this program tends to work better if you don't drink. They said, keep coming back. They let me have little jobs to do in the group, thinking that might help me someday get sober. But they always said, keep coming back. Isn't that amazing? Nowhere in the book does it say, don't drink no matter what. Nowhere. Because with a defiant personality like mine, if you tell me don't drink no matter what, I'm off and running. This book is my guide. It says, keep coming back. It says to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him. And by the way, you guys became my God as I understood Him when I was new. November 8, 1977, I've been going to meetings for 5 years drinking. And on the eve of November 8th, my sponsor asked me to do something he'd never asked me to do in 5 years of being my sponsor while I went to meetings drinking. He says, I want you to give me your word that you'll try not to drink tonight and you'll meet me tomorrow for the noon meeting and help me set up. And before I could, I wanted to impress him. So I very grandiosely gave him my word of honor. And then I wanted to take it back. Because I said, I'll stay sober tonight, not a problem. Now, bear in mind, I hadn't been drunk for a couple of days. Now I want to get drunk. I gave him my word, I want to get drunk. Isn't that amazing how we are? So long about midnight, I had a critical decision to make. Is this a new day? I told him I wouldn't drink last night, but that was hard. So I made it through until about 7:15 in the morning. Then I realized I had to meet him early for the noon meeting. And so on my way to the noon meeting, I stole a six-pack of Budweiser. And I got to the group about 9:15 in the morning, early, because he said, be there early. So I'm sitting on the front steps of my home group, having been to meetings for 5 years now, unable to stop drinking. And I sit down on the front steps of my home group and start drinking my beer. I've got three empty cans of beer drank. The cans are on the ground. Three more in my lap with every single intention of drinking them. It wasn't even a conscious thing. It was a foregone conclusion. And guess who shows up about 10? Barney, my sponsor. He came ultra early because he was one of those. Comes walking up the sidewalk, and he does what the old-timers do. No judgment. He may have been, but he didn't let me see it. He didn't even look at the beer. Instead, he did something worse. Looked me right in the eye, causing me to look at the beer. You know, it didn't bother me drinking at all till he showed up. I'm expecting to be admonished, wouldn't you? Instead, he says, "Dummy." I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "Why don't you come in and help me set up for the meeting?" And I looked at the other three cans of beer, and I said, "I'll be in a minute." And he went in, and I heard that door slam quietly shut. And I looked at that beer, and it was my moment. That's why I know nobody's hopeless. Nobody is hopeless here, because this was my moment. If I'd have known it was going to be my last drink, I'd have had a hell of a lot more. I hid the other three cans of beer in the bush in case I might need them during the meeting. Big Book Bob might show up. And every time Bob shared, I drank. Every group's got a Bob. You see, Bob's never drank since he came to AA. And he's got to share it every damn time he talks, no matter what the topic is. He'll make it about the fact he hasn't drank since he came to AA. And then he looks right at me, the slipper. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, Bob, one might not hurt. I mean, I could see him on the street and I'd get thirsty. So I hid the other cans of beer in the bush because I thought Bob might come to the meeting. And then I went in and helped Barney set up for the meeting. It's an amazing power we have here that we can't see. It's an amazing power, this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I helped him set up for the meeting, and I sat down at the Arounder table because Barney was now up at the newcomer coffee. And see, at my home group, we had the Arounder table, and we had the newcomer coffee bar. The Arounders, you know, those who have been around just can't get it, they sit at the Arounder table. They don't want us at the newcomer bar infecting the newcomers. They called the Arounder table the AA shoebox. It's where they put the sneakers, runners, slippers, and AA loafers. So I'm sitting in the shoebox, watching my sponsor talk to this newcomer who's been coming around for a while. I hated his guts because now he's got my sponsor's attention and I don't. Barney said, "Pray for him." I did. He didn't die. I said, "See, Barney, there ain't no God. I prayed. He ain't dead." He said, "You might want to pray different." Okay, I pray he dies suddenly. So Barney's up there talking to him. I'm at the Arounder table feeling sorry for myself. I mean, we have set up the meeting. I should be a legend now. I'm the kind of guy that I come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where I see Bill and Bob's picture on the wall, and I visualize mine floating up between them. So Barney's up there talking to this newcomer, and I'm sitting over here praying he dies. And some guy comes flying through the front door drunk. We thought it was his wife who shoved him through. We assumed him. Well, it wasn't his wife. I did what Barney did to me 5 years earlier. You see, 5 years earlier, Barney came up to me and he says, "Hi, my name's Barney. I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to be your sponsor." That's what he did. I said, "Okay." Because I knew what his sponsor was. The tavern I played softball for was our sponsor. They paid our uniforms, our fees, bought our beer. So when he said he's going to be my sponsor, I said, "Okay." Psychiatrists call that loose association. So I'm sitting at the Arounder table, having been to meetings for 5 years, drank at almost every one of them, but I've never uttered the words, "I'm an alcoholic," like Barney did 5 years earlier. I'm never saying that, because if I say I'm an alcoholic, I have to be here with you. because I'm not really alcoholic. I've got a lot of problems, but I'm not alcoholic. God works in mysterious ways. Do you know God uses us? Did you know that? He's a user of useless people. So I'm sitting there being useless. We'll call him Jim, comes flying to the front door. I notice Barney's busy with his new camera. So I thought, well, I might as well do something. So I remember what Barney did. And I got up out of my chair, went over and grabbed Jim by the hand. I said, hi, I'm Wayne B. I'm an alcoholic. I knew I said it. I didn't mean to. And I thought, well, what the hell? I'm going to be your sponsor. He goes like this. What's a sponsor? I wasn't expecting a difficult question. So I said the patent answer, shut up. Now, I've only had 3 cans of beer. I'm having a lucid interval. I haven't been drunk for a few days. He's drunk. He can't smell my breath. So he says, okay. So I got my first sponsee, and I'm sober about 2.5 hours. Barney hears it. Barney heard me tell him I'd be a sponsor. He abandoned his newcomer and came over to poach mine. So I'm serious. As Barney's approaching, I bring Jimmy around. Because I know Barney's after him. I've seen that look before. He gets this far from my face. And he held my life in his hands. He could have said something that's popular. There's a lot of stuff, by the way, creeping into AA that has absolutely nothing to do with our work. For instance, dummy, he could have said, you can't sponsor him till you've been sober a year. What crap is that? I looked. Not in there. Dummy, you can't sponsor him till you've worked all 12 steps. Not in here. Could you imagine Bill Wilson got sober December of 1934? AA was founded June 10th, 1935, 6 months, where nobody he talked to got sober. Can you imagine today what we'd say to him? You know, Bill, you might want to take him to detox. You're not doing too good. You know, Bill, you might want to work those steps you haven't wrote yet. You know, Bill, you better write that book so you know what the hell you're doing. Didn't the guy hang himself at your house? Bill, your track record ain't looking too good. Boy, it can get serious around here, can't it? Instead, he said, go grab him and bring him here. What he didn't tell me, here's what he whispered in my ear, dummy. I don't want him talking to me like that in front of my sponsee. You know, pride's the first thing to come back. He says, dummy. I said, what? He says, do you mind if I co-sponsor him? I thought, what the hell is that? Co-sponsor? No! No, I'm not sharing him. He's mine. You've had me for 5 years. By God, it's my turn. That's not what I said. That's what I thought. What I said was okay. And then I found out later, Barney got with Jimmy on the sly. And he says, Jimmy, we're going to let Wayne think he sponsors you. It might help keep him sober. So whatever he tells you to do, you make sure you tell me what he told you to do. I didn't find out about that until we were both 10 years sober. I gave him his 10-year cake thinking I was his sponsor. Really perturbed me. Now, last November 8th, Jimmy called me up from Port Byron, Illinois, at 6 a.m. to wish me a happy birthday. And then I hung up and called him back and wished him happy birthday. He has to call me first because I have a couple hours more time. Jimmy was gay. He wasn't married. It wasn't a wife that shoved him to the door. We assumed that. He's a good man. Barney told us to go grab newcomers, and me and Jimmy did. We worked them over bad. We was horrible. We was killing them. We'd go into taverns 12-stepping people that weren't asking. Let me tell you, that gets violent. Did I mention what I looked like at that time? At that time, I weighed 146 pounds. And now at the gym yesterday, I weighed 262. That's what I weigh right now. I weighed 146 pounds. I didn't have any teeth. Funny thing, ignore your teeth. They will go away. And the ones that didn't go away, the police took away. I'd have swore they said, stand up. So when I got sober, I weighed 146 pounds. I didn't have any teeth. I had long hair down to my butt, full beard and mustache, and I had a human stench that I could not wash off. It took over 6 months for that human stench to leave my body. And you guys sat with me at every meeting, sent me out doing 12-step work where I smelled worse than the people I was 12-stepping. And I stayed sober, but for the grace of God. And over the course of the past 28 years, very interesting things have happened in and around my life, of which I get to only take a little bit of credit for, and that's that I've suited up and showed up and kept doing the drill. And there's not a lot of credit to that. People do that without any attention at all, don't they? I had no idea how sick I was. I had no idea that it goes far beyond just having a little old diseasey poop. I have a condition of mind and body and emotion that only a spiritual experience can conquer. When it says no human power could relieve me, it's absolutely true, though I've tried. Wilson talked about faulty emotional dependencies that we place on people, places, and things for our feelings of self-satisfaction, approval, and worthiness, safety, and protection. And I've had my debacle with faulty dependencies on people, places, and things. I didn't have relationships. I took hostages. I'm a guy who ran around with his umbilical cord looking to plug in. Lock and load. You taught me how to overcome that one day at a time. When I got here, those racist, prejudiced, bigoted, homophobic, sexist views didn't just go away overnight. They had to wear away. And thank God that everybody that I was affiliated with in AA had a little bit of the same problem, and we began to work them out together. Because you see, AA is colorblind. This book sees no color. It doesn't even see sex. It was written in the male gender, as was all literature. But it's neutral. And so there's no religion in here, although there is a taint of one. No matter what race, religion, creed, color, we get to be here. And that scared me. Because if you were different from me, I didn't know how to handle that. And what I found out was that you were reminding me of all my little differences one at a time. And if I don't find a solution for that, I'm going to find the one that always worked, King Alcohol, the great equalizer. Gave me emotional balance and maturity, even though it was just in the figment of my imagination. And let me tell you something, when I'm feeling suicidal, whatever was in the figment of my imagination is what comes to the surface immediately. And that's what I retreat to. And I have to have something that produces an alcohol-like effect, a spiritual effect, but it has to be real. I'm here to suggest to you newcomers, if AA was anything near as fast as the effect produced by alcohol, we'd have 25 million sober members instead of 2.5. Because you see, alcohol worked like that, didn't it? It did in me. And Alcoholics Anonymous is just so painfully slow. But it's also real, you see. I have taken the painstaking measures. I'm committed to getting better today. I'm no longer committed to feeling better, because recovery doesn't feel better most of the time, does it? I do things I don't want to do. We was talking about my seats to USC. I got tickets for the USC-UCLA game. Guess what? I got to give them to a newcomer because I'm going to be speaking. Happy day. Can't wait for that crowd. I continue to work the 12 steps daily. I do 10, 11, and 12. I'm into the practical, mechanical, spiritual aspect of step 10, 11, and 12 on a daily basis because my illness requires for me to take daily action. Because if I don't, if this alcoholic doesn't do daily maintenance, I will sicken and die ever so slowly, and I'm not going to go alone. Sober. You know, we expect to see newcomers. I'm like a fart in a mitten. You know I'm there. You just can't catch me. That's a horrible analogy, isn't it? You knew what you were dealing with when you invited me. I was told 7 years sober by a psychiatrist that I would never be able to walk the streets free any longer of medication, that I would need to be medicated. 7 years sober, I was carrying a weapon. I remember I grabbed this newcomer when I was 6.5 years sober, and he was talking about, if I drink, I'll die. If I drink, I die. So I grabbed him and put a gun to his head, and I said, you ain't got to worry about drinking and dying. I'll just take care of it right now. My sponsor said, that's not effective 12-step work. I was having a bit of a depression. I went and saw a psychiatrist because some well-meaning AAs told me to ignore my sponsor and go see a doctor, and I listened. And I got misdiagnosed one more time. I was diagnosed bipolar manic depressive with a chemical imbalance 7 years sober. I was told to go on lithium, amitriptyline, and a new chemical that was approved by the FDA in 1985 called Prozac. And I said, yes, I'd be glad to because I can't take it anymore. And I got those three medications. And then I called my sponsor, 7 years sober. I was dying. I wanted out, and I didn't have the guts to kill myself. So I went and told my sponsor what I'd done. I said, I know what's wrong with me, Barney, after all these years. He says, what's that? I'm bipolar. Of course you are. It's funny how when sponsors agree with you, you should run. And I said, no, I am. I'm bipolar. I know what's wrong. I got some pills. I'm going to be better now. He said, yeah, you're bipolar, all right. One of these days, you're going to be walking down 16th Street. You're going to hear the loudest explosion you've ever heard. It's going to be your head popping right out of your ass. It wasn't that funny. And you won't be bipolar no more. He says, I don't know about that stuff, but I do know this. I know that you have not lived the AA way of life. You've piecemealed it. You've done what you've wanted to do. You've taken what you've wanted and left the rest. He says, why don't you give yourself completely to this program and see if it helps? Because he says, I don't know about that psychiatric stuff, but I've seen it in other people, and Bill Wilson overcame it as well. And you know what? I decided not to take the medication because I knew I lied to the doctor. I knew I exaggerated my symptoms. I knew that. I just wanted the pain to stop. Lots of us lie about our symptoms to get something so the pain will stop. Because I'm into feeling better. I'm not into getting better. And I put that medication aside, didn't take any. And you know what I did? I got this, imagine that, got this book out. And didn't interpret it. Just applied it. It's so simple when you don't interpret it. I applied this book and I found my symptoms in the 12 and 12. Finding my symptoms made this book believable, and that is what cemented my ability to act upon change. And here I am now, 28 years. My depression went away within 2 years. I haven't been depressed since. Do I appear depressed to you? Do I appear bipolar? Maybe I do. I don't know. I might be. I don't know. But I'm going to accept the things I cannot change. That was 20 years ago, ladies and gentlemen. And what I found out is I'm a high-maintenance alcoholic. I'm a Bill W. type to the 10th power. I don't personally want to be medicated. I want to live free. And I found out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that alcoholics of my type, and by the way, if you're on medication, don't come up and try to help me understand after the meeting. And if you're a therapist, don't offer me any help. I don't want it. No offense. That has happened. You know that? I've had them give me business cards and offer to give me free help. Did anybody hear me give a diagnosis of anybody else? Anybody hear me give an opinion? Don't go out of here saying I'm giving opinions. I'm not. This is my personal experience. Now here I am. The depression's gone. Has not to this day come back. Being sad is not depression. Sad is sad. I remember, how many of you have been in love? How many of you have been so much in love you had to quit work? I fell in love in AA with a woman I arrested. Oh, did I tell you I became a cop? Did I mention I became a cop? Sober? You know, it's really hard to become a cop when you've been arrested 9 times for domestic violence. 2 for attempted murder, although I was found not guilty. And I've been psychiatrically institutionalized 17 times. It's hard to become a cop. Unless you live in Iowa. There they consider it a good experience. True story. Sheriff Bob Rice, 1987-1992. He shouldn't have hired me, but he did. You see, I followed my sponsor's suggestions. He said, get your record expunged. Then he told me how to do it. I did it, and it happened, and I became a police officer. Can you imagine that? So I got people riding around in the back. It's a long walk from the back seat to the front seat of that squad car. And when I got a guy in my back seat that I've arrested for drunk driving, I'm not taking any delight in it except that I get to do 12-step work all the way to jail. I have a captive audience. And I'm going to talk to him all. You know, I ended up sponsoring a lot of the alcoholics I arrested so they didn't have to go to prison. I was able to sponsor them. I'm not taking credit. Don't misunderstand this. God used me again. You see, if I will give myself up to this way of life and follow the flow of AA, God will use me. Not according to my plan, but according to his plan. It's an amazing thing. And God, I fell in love with one of those girls. It's fun when you fall in love with someone you arrest. I always like to say I already had her in handcuffs, but you know. I'm not trying to pervert the podium. That was the truth. But we got engaged 10 years later. And it's the first human being I've allowed myself to bond to, other than my sponsor. And I gave her that ring that was going to be my car. And we were happy. And we sent out 400 save the date postcards. And before they got delivered, she changed her mind. She gave me the ring back and says, I'm in love with somebody else. This was an old idea. And I said, okay. I took the ring back and did what my sponsor taught me to do. Do not take away her dignity by asking her why. That's tough. I let her go, and then I said, why? And now I'm on the floor in the fetal position. 2 a.m. crying. And I call a guy named Clancy. Don't even like the guy. Called him at 2 a.m. I can't get a hold of my sponsor. And he says, where you at, kid? I said, well, I'm on the kitchen floor. What you doing down there? Well, I seem to be in the fetal position. He knew what happened. He knew the story. And he says, well, kid, now you know the tragedy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, what? I never heard of that. No one. Now you know the tragedy of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, we don't have one single step to work that's going to mend your broken heart. He says, I hope you got a lot of commitments to keep you busy till that pain passes, and it will pass. Click! When? He knew that was coming. And here I am. I've been in love again since. I didn't think it. I'm a one-time only guy. I'm all or nothing. That would be a real ugly God, wouldn't it? That would create a person like me with the amount of capacity to love that I have and for me to squander it in just one attempt. That's how I am. And then get a room full of people like this that love me beyond the capacity to understand. And you've given me that. You've given me the opportunity to work with other people. People trust me. It's an amazing thing. Not a cop anymore. I live back in California again. I work with others. My sponsor died 4 years ago. And I really knew what a broken heart meant then. He was my sponsor for 29 years, 5 months, and 4 days. And he held me to my commitment to the very end. I'm glad I did the steps daily when he died, because I was ready for it. It was in April, and we knew he wasn't going to live through the weekend. Now, I have to admit to you, I ran out on my mom when she died. I couldn't sit with her. I also have to admit to you, I ran out on my dad when he died. I could not sit with him. I made the decision I was not running out on my sponsor. And so I'm visiting him on Thursday night, and I'm scheduled to go to Nashville, Tennessee to speak at a retreat that Scott L. had put together called The Usual Suspects. And Tom I. and myself were kind of co-doing the thing. And I decided not to go. And it's the first time in 29 years, 5 months, and 4 days I didn't run that decision past my sponsor first. I'm not going. I'm staying with my sponsor because I know he's going to die this weekend. So I'm at the foot of his bed, rubbing his feet and reading the big book to him. And all of a sudden, his head comes up. Now, his head ain't been up for a while. Head comes up, and I heard this raspy voice, "Dummy." You'd think after almost 30 years he'd figure out how to say, "Wayne, dummy." "What?" He says, "Ain't it about time you left and got packing?" I said, "For what?" He says, "Aren't you supposed to be in Nashville tomorrow carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I looked at my sponsor and I said, "I'm not going. I'm staying right here with you." And I'll tell you, he sat up in bed for the first time in weeks. He says, "No, you're not. You're going to Nashville. Go home and pack now. I don't need you here to die. But some mope that doesn't know any better might need to hear your message so they have a chance to live in AA." So I got on the airplane, hated him again. And we landed in Nashville, and I'm getting ready to walk into a maximum security penitentiary in Nashville, Tennessee. Because they were taking me and Tom to different prisons on Friday night before we went to the retreat. And as I'm getting ready to walk into the prison, my cell phone goes off and it's my best friend. And you know, I'd forgotten about Barney being sick because I'm now caught up in the activities of AA. Barney knew that would happen. My phone rings and I had a bad feeling. And then that's when TJ asked me if I was with anybody. "Yeah. Are you in a place where you can sit down?" And that's when he said it. Barney just died. And you know what? I don't know. Tom told me I could go home if I wanted to. Everybody would understand. And I said, "Okay." He says, "I'll take you to the airport myself." I said, "Okay." And as I'm turning to walk like I'm going to leave, he says, "But could I ask you one question?" I said, "Yeah." "What do you think Barney'd have you do?" Even Daddy's getting me. I went in, and the inmates carried the message to me that night because Tom informed them that my sponsor had just passed away, and all these hardened convicts brought the message to me that night. Isn't that how AA works? And I wasn't going to go. So if you're new, the message is really simple. We just do this thing one day at a time. We try to pass on what's been given to us freely to the best of our human ability. And one of the reasons I do what I'm doing right now, I'd like to read to you in Dr. Bob's own words, because it's the only reason I do it. It's one, a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. It has been. You guys are fun. Because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. And because I'm a slipper, I have to do all four of those things. I get to, like all the service workers here do. I want to continue to do that because it isn't so much that I'm afraid I'm going to go back to drinking. I don't ever want to feel that emptiness I felt 28 years ago that I didn't think could ever be filled. And tonight I'm full. I've been told I'm full of it, but tonight I'm full because I've been with you for the last hour or so. And some people think that I'm up here doing something for you. That's not true. I'm up here getting something for me. Because there's only one of me, but there's about 250 of you, and your power is exacting a change in me. And I know that, so very selfishly I'm coming here. And so I appreciate the invite and your courtesy. Thanks for letting me share.